We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep, and Meditation Studio, the five-star app. I'm Patricia Karpus. Check out the Muse headband, as always, at choosemuse.com. Today's guest is Andrea Small. Andrea is a design leader, strategist, educator, and former Stanford University D-School teaching fellow. We discuss her book, Navigating Ambiguity, Creating Opportunity in a World of Unknowns. The timing is perfect for this book, as many of us personally, professionally, and in the world at large are dealing with unknowns. We talk about the differences between ambiguity and uncertainty, and how we can embrace the discomfort of the unknown to create new, innovative, and creative possibilities. She invites us to lean into not knowing, to be more open to being surprised. The inside cover of the book says it perfectly. The book shows you how to surrender control by being adaptable, curious, and unbiased, as well as resourceful, tenacious, and courageous. I felt the book had a lot to teach us beyond its original intention for design and education. So much of it can be applied to anything we do or any problem we want to solve. Now, here's Andrea. Andrea, it's so great to have you on Untangle today. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a really great honor.
Yeah. Your book, Navigating Ambiguity, Creating Opportunity in a World of Unknowns, for some reason just hit me at exactly the right time. And I felt like I looked at it as almost the answer to everything. It was such an interesting read, but I'm going to read this one quote that is in the beginning of the book, just so people understand, have a little context. But the design process presents a series of steps, but in real life, it's rarely this neat. Navigating ambiguity underscores how the creative process isn't formulaic. The book shows you how to surrender control by being adaptable, curious, and unbiased, as well as resourceful, tenacious, and courageous. And as I read through this book, I just kept thinking, this is so far beyond human-centered design or the design process. It's so much about life. But why don't you start by telling us your inspiration for writing the book and maybe give us a little bit of a definition of ambiguity and the difference between ambiguity and uncertainty in your mind? I'd love to hear all that.
Absolutely. And my co-author, Kelly Schmude, and I just would love to hear that this is the answer to everything, especially right now, of course, where everybody is experiencing so much uncertainty. The inspiration for the book really came from a teaching fellowship that I did at Stanford at the D School in 2015, 2016. And my cohort of teaching fellows and I, there are three of us, our very first challenge was to design a class. And that was it. That was all the information we were given from the D-School, design a class. It could be for anyone. It could be anywhere. It could be about anything at any time, for any length of time. It was just so open. There were no constraints. And we started to notice that was going on a lot. There was a lot of uncertainty for a lot of people. And we turned a mirror on the D-School and started to think there's so much ambiguity and uncertainty in design. And this is really where people get uncomfortable and where we lose people in the design process and where they really struggle. And we just kind of expect design students or even executives while they're learning the design process or human-centered design to just be good at it, to just be great at all of that uncertainty, at all of that unknown, but we don't really objectively teach them how to do it. So we wondered if that could be taught. And Navigating Ambiguity started then as a class, as a workshop that we taught to students, that we prototyped, and then it was more like a pamphlet at the beginning. We're like, great, well, let's distribute this pamphlet that has activities for helping people navigate ambiguity. But the book you see today really started in 2019 when Kelly and I started to work together, and the D School had this vision for a series of books. So what we imagined back in 2015, 2016 was more like a zine. And what you see today is like, it's a real book.
It's a real book, yes.
It's a real book. But the coursework really led us to unraveling some of those definitions. So to start with, what is the difference between ambiguity and uncertainty? We say in the book that uncertainty and ambiguity are different, and I do believe that they're different. Uncertainty implies that there's something to be certain about, that there is an answer. Most of the time we're dealing with uncertainty when we're waiting. We're waiting for some conclusion to come. Ambiguity is about holding multiple truths as reality. It's about multiplicity or dualities. It's about multiple interpretations and possibility, but it's not necessarily waiting for an answer. In the design process, however, in the creative process in general, not just the design process, uncertainty, ambiguity, the unknown, all of that gets meshed together. Whereas in other sciences or even in literature, uncertainty and ambiguity are very different. Here in the creative process, we lump them all together as one.
It's so interesting that you started it with this idea or this question of, can it be taught? Can navigating ambiguity be taught? And what is the toolbox that ends up being the answer to that question? And I think it's interesting that you talk about handling multiple truths. We've interviewed Sarah, the executive director of the D School, on our show, and she was amazing. Will you, for people who might not have heard that interview, just talk about the D School and what the design process is and why understanding or navigating ambiguity is so important to that?
Absolutely. So the D School is Stanford's Center for Creativity and Innovation. We teach human-centered design and design thinking as it applies to all sorts of creative problems. It's certainly not just for designers. The D School offers classes to everyone across campus. So that would be in education, in law, in medicine, in social impact. Anyone from any industry really could come and learn aspects of the design process or human-centered design. Human-centered design is really centering people in the design process as opposed to centering technology, let's say, where we're encouraging people to go out and to learn, to unpack their biases, and to actually work with the people that they're designing for in order to create products that really work best for them. And ambiguity comes in because of people. Every time you engage with people, you're entering into a whole world of unknowns. People are unpredictable. You're not dealing with technology or something that could be well-defined. You're always learning something new when you invite other people into the process. And when you collaborate, it's the same thing. So we are very focused on getting people to collaborate with one another and to collaborate interdisciplinarily. I think the thought of design thinking and human-centered design from the beginning was really, how do we bring together all of these different subject matter experts, whether that's a designer, a scientist, a writer, all these different people to come together to work on different projects. And when you have that amount of diversity, that's when you really start to enter into the unknown, because you're opening yourself up to all of these potential other pathways. And you're asking people to really make sense of all of this information and inspiration and data, where that could be really difficult for people. It could be very, very, very messy.
On this podcast, because we talk a lot about mindfulness and resilience and whatnot, we talk about comfort with not knowing, or beginner's mind, or having a growth versus a fixed mindset. How do some of those things connect with ambiguity, and why does ambiguity in and of itself hold so much creative possibility?
It holds so much creative possibility. Like, if you think of the opposite of ambiguity, which might be certainty or the known or just having one answer, you block yourself off to all of those other possibilities. As soon as you choose one particular interpretation, then ambiguity naturally disappears. If you tell yourself that it can only be this one thing, or it can only be interpreted in this one particular way, then your brain closes it off to all of the different possible options. And it is deeply, deeply related to meditation and mindfulness. In fact, when we first started teaching the course, part of the exercises was kind of a body mapping exercise of where do you feel ambiguity in your body? Like, how does your body react to situations of ambiguity? Where do you feel it? And we spent a lot of time really thinking about how meditation could be used as a way to help people cope with ambiguity and uncertainty in the creative process.
I'm curious, what are some of the emotions that go with ambiguity? Are these like very difficult emotions? Do most people have a hard time holding ambiguity? Or through this process, they can release that tension?
Unfortunately, for a lot of answers about ambiguity, it's so context dependent. I know you know this. There's no one right answer to that question. I will say that a lot of people feel anxious and stressed. And those feelings of anxiety that come up from ambiguity are our natural reaction, our instincts, our amygdala kicking in every single time to tell us that we don't like uncertainty. We like certainty because certainty keeps us safe. And the unknown is scary and could potentially harm us. And therefore, our brain wants to eliminate uncertainty all of the time. And so when we feel anxiety and stress because of uncertainty or ambiguity, that's our natural brain just kicking in and telling us that that uncertainty could harm us. And unfortunately, our brain doesn't necessarily decipher from the uncertainty of, say, walking past a dark alley versus trying to solve a complex problem.
And you have this quote in the book, only in the absence of certainty can we have open-mindedness, mental flexibility, and willingness to contemplate alternative ideas. But I love how you're relating this to neuroscience and the brain's desperate attempt to stay safe. That creates this pressure for us to have all the answers, which is inconsistent with being with ambiguity. You have I don't know what to call these chapters or sections, but you have an area that looks at the characteristics of tolerance versus intolerance for ambiguity. Can you discuss that a bit?
Absolutely. We were inspired by a list of characteristics that represent intolerance from ambiguity that is from Stephen Bochner from 1965. And those intolerance characteristics are things like need for categorization, need for certainty, premature closure. And we took a humorous pass at what tolerance would look like on the other side. So take, for example, premature closure. The opposite of that, a tolerance for ambiguity then would be patience. We talk about ambiguity in the design process really as a moment to stew and to let those ideas marinate. And when you pick something, when you settle on one idea initially, that could lead to premature closure where you close yourself off to all of the additional possibilities. And if you have some of that patience to entertain different possibilities, you could get to something potentially different from where you started.
What's the challenge with sitting with that? Is it because we're impatient? Do we have a gut feeling that we might have the answer already? Because what happens in this, I look at it as almost the space between two trapeze. You haven't let go of one and you're reaching for the other, but you're somewhere in between. What's happening there that's making it so unclear when we should close on a particular idea?
We definitely bring in our own ideas. And we see that in teaching. And I see that I work in advanced technology. We see that in corporations, businesses all the time, where there is this drive to eliminate uncertainty, to eliminate ambiguity wherever possible. And that's partially that we don't have the patience, but it's also reality. We don't have the budget. We don't have the calendar days. We don't have the hours. There are all these pressures demanding us to figure it out as soon as possible. So when we're confronted with a lot of possibilities, we have all of these opposing forces, not only our brain telling us that maybe this is it, maybe this is it, maybe this is it, but also all of these outside pressures telling us that we need to figure it out and get it settled so that we can move on to something else. In the beginning of the book, we talk a little bit about how ambiguity is typically thought of as a roadblock, like something that you need to eliminate in order to achieve a goal. But it's really this ever-present layer of life. It's a layer of meaning that we apply to unambiguous stuff. It's not necessarily the gap between platforms on the trapeze. There's so much possibility between the platform, on the other platform. It's just stretching your brain to think creatively about all of those possibilities.
And how do you ever know when you've reached the end?
Maybe there is no end.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you've ever thought about therapy and haven't quite jumped in yet, it may be the right time to explore BetterHelp. Whether you're looking for new coping skills or to improve a relationship, or maybe dealing with some social anxiety or just need to recharge your batteries so you can be the best version of yourself, therapy is great. And this could be just the right time to give BetterHelp a shot. Finding a therapist through BetterHelp is easy. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and they do their best to match you with a licensed therapist that's a great fit for you. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now back to our show.
Thinking mad as I said that. But it does make me think about some of the things that are going on in the world right now. Even with the vaccine, there's been so much debate. And do you need a vaccine booster every 6 months, every 4 months? Do you even need it? And scientists are so uncomfortable with uncertainty and ambiguity. It's almost like a badge of honor to say you're absolutely right until you're proven wrong. And so in areas like this that involve our health and well-being, what role can ambiguity play? And would we ever as a country accept the person that stands up and says, I don't know?
I wish that our country would accept the person that stands up and says that I don't know. We've been driving towards one model of leadership, one way of creating answers and having answers all of the time. It's different when you're talking about something like a vaccine because lives are on the line. There can't be uncertainty when you're dealing with something like that. But there has been a lot of ambiguity in communication, a lot of mixed messages, a lot of confusing directives. And just also a lot of unknowns. We don't know if we're going to develop an immunity to the vaccine or if the vaccine needs to change or how the disease is going to change or whatever. There are all these unknowns to that. And people want answers. They want answers so that they can make decisions about their lives that keep their family safe and that can keep their family healthy and also active and back in society. And so we're very quick to want those answers. And it's really painful and uncomfortable when those answers just simply aren't there. And design does touch all of that. There's design in how we communicate things like vaccines or how we design a rollout plan for vaccines. All of that is really open to interpretation. And even though we know that we don't have all the answers, it's just so uncomfortable that people just don't want to go there. And to have a leader stand up and say that they don't know would be a very disruptive and different thing. I wish that we would be comfortable with that.
It would be a very brave thing, but we've just culturally been so acclimated to self-esteem, self-confidence, and it being based on a knowing. So this idea of ambiguity is in direct conflict with that.
Mm-hmm. And leaders having answers. Leaders should know.
Leaders should know. Yes. You also have a section that goes over the attitudes that people have about ambiguity. Some people endure, some people engage, some people embrace. What are these different attitudes and how do they impact us?
So the different attitudes really came out from an exercise that my co-author Kelly Schmude and others on the teaching and learning team at the D School did with students around creating metaphors for ambiguity. So ambiguity is like blank because blank. And at this point, Kelly and I have done this activity and other people within the D School community thousands, like probably 1,000 times. And every single time we do this activity, we get radically different answers. It's very, very interesting. And they did a large amount of synthesis on, say, 150 of these metaphors from students. And we continued to do that synthesis. And what we found is that these, we're not saying there's just three, of course, it's a book about ambiguity. So we're not just saying there's three, but there's these three general areas where people have an attitude of comfort or discomfort. And the first one is endure. That's the mindset of ambiguity is a bad thing. It's a thing coming between me and some known or me and my goal, and I need to get rid of it. Or I just need to hunker down and hold on tight until it's over. And that's the first mindset or attitude towards ambiguity. The second is engage. And that those metaphors and that attitude points to where people understand that it's something that you can reach into and something that you could potentially think about in a creative way. So how might you use ambiguity or the unknown to unlock creative possibilities? But maybe there's like a hesitancy or you like to dip your toe into it occasionally, but that's not where you like to live. And then the attitude of embrace is really accepting that ambiguity is just a part of life. It's a chosen gamble. It is an ever-present layer. It's something that you feel more sometimes and sometimes you feel less, but you embrace its existence. And these three attitudes are definitely not three types of people, because I might be enduring uncertainty this morning when I wake up and listen to the radio and hear about what is going on in the Supreme Court or what is going on with gun laws. I may be enduring a lot of uncertainty at that moment in time. And I may be embracing ambiguity right now in this interview. It's like, I haven't done many of these. This is super interesting to me. This is exciting to me. So it's definitely not three types of people. It could be at any point of any day, you might feel all three things at once. That's the fun part of ambiguity.
Yeah, that makes sense. What role does self-awareness play? So in your first class, when you were starting to teach this, how did you teach self-awareness?
I think kind of a classic approach, like naming it, creating the definition, sharing the definition, rather, having people unpack what ambiguity is in order to unlock how you feel personally about ambiguity. So that's just the facts. Here are some examples. Here's what it means. Here's where you might encounter it. Okay, now let's talk about you and your reaction to it. I think that area is super interesting because we've driven in the creative world or the world of even just work in general, really led to people separating who they are from their work. That initial, it's work-life balance, but now we know that we want people to bring their whole selves to work. We want them to feel psychologically safe at work and to be who they are. So how you react to uncertainty or ambiguity is deeply connected to who you are as a person, to your context, to your experience, to your life, to all sorts of aspects of who you are. And no one has experienced the same thing. So if someone, for example, has a great deal of trauma, they might react very differently to uncertainty in the workplace to somebody else who maybe doesn't have that type of experience. And that isn't to say that if someone has a great amount of trauma in their past, that they're not good at ambiguity in the workplace. Actually, they might be the best because they're so used to it. So it really is super personal and starting to think about like, wow, yeah, I have dealt with a lot of ambiguity in my life. And that does make me slightly more comfortable. And I am becoming aware of how I react to ambiguity. Even if it isn't in an attempt to control it, it's just in an attempt to understand it. Like when I'm deeply unsure of something, I'm breathing into a paper bag. That's just how it is.
When you were teaching this to undergraduate students or graduate students or all students?
All students.
All students. Such great teachings.
Yeah, we executives, graduate students, other members of the teaching and learning community, so other educators, PhD students, undergrads, everyone.
I love this quote. Designers like deep sea divers and explorers dive into the ocean of ambiguity because they see opportunity in the deep, dark recesses of the possible. If you engage in ambiguity in the realm of multiple right answers and unturned stones, you are rewarded by the exact thing you might have been afraid of, the unexpected. It's one of my favorites.
The metaphor that I like, and actually one of the very first people we talked to who shared this metaphor about ambiguity inspired a lot of this work, or she was talking about deep sea exploration and how deep sea divers lay out a matrix on the seabed to guide their exploration. And if they find a treasure chest in square 1A, they don't call off the entire exploration. They continue to look in square 1B, 1C, 1D, because you might find a whole sunken ship somewhere in the rest of the matrix, or you might find a new species of fish, or you might not find anything at all. But you could always come back to that treasure chest or that first thing that you found. But we're encouraging people to, even though you might think that you have found the thing, to continue looking for the sake of exploration, knowing that you might find something or you might find nothing. And that does mean something as well.
It's an amazing exercise, because that feeling that you've found something is such a complete feeling, and to let that go and keep going is a really powerful exercise.
Mm-hmm. I know that that's very familiar to people in the design industry as well. We talk about people bringing in their own ideas or getting stuck on the first idea and not being open to everybody else's stuff. And again, that's just our brain craving certainty and craving the closure in order to move on, instead of embracing the fact that maybe that's not it.
And you talk a bit later on about the default mode network, which is the part of the brain that goes on autopilot, if you will, and that part of the brain doesn't probably want to deal at all with ambiguity. You also talk about unhealthy ambiguity. What is that?
Yes. Yeah, so there's a section of the book that we lovingly call the dark side. And that spread initially was longer. And honestly, I feel like that spread of the dark side of ambiguity could really be its own book. Ambiguity shows up in all sorts of unhealthy ways as well. Ambiguity can be used as a manipulation tactic to keep people guessing. It could be used to control others. In unhealthy relationships, this could look like ghosting someone or misdirecting them or whatever it is. In the workplace, this could look like changing roles and expectations, unclear directives, just unclear communication. There's a lot of different ways that it could show up in the workplace, gaslighting. And then in life, we see it in fake news. We see it in refusing directives from the CDC. I mean, like, truly, there's all sorts of unhealthy types of ambiguity that are used by other people to control. And we want to recognize that, because for me personally, my biggest fear about the focus on ambiguity in the recent years, and it's not a trend, it's just going to keep becoming more and more of a topic. My fear is that when I see on job descriptions for, especially in the tech industry, I'm sure it's everywhere else, but there's always this line of must be good at handling ambiguity, must thrive in a workplace, work quickly with little information. It's always there. And then I see a lot of people being put in these impossible scenarios at work and then being told that they're not able to handle ambiguity, when the ambiguity is actually unhealthy and not a good thing to have in the workplace. So my fear is that ambiguity will continue to be this metric for whether or not someone is good at their job, when the ambiguity is unhealthy to begin with and shouldn't be there.
That's interesting. And then you talk about wayfinders, and how do they fit in, your concept of wayfinders fit in with human-centered design? And maybe you can discuss a little bit about, I remember there were two areas, one was acting and one was adapting. Will you share your thoughts on that?
Yes, absolutely. So co-author Kelly did a lot of research with Wayfinders. She interviewed people from the Polynesian Wayfinding Society, did a lot of work on this because there's so much correlation between purpose and navigation and the design process. And we want to recognize we certainly didn't invent any of this. Navigating uncertainty has been around as long as people have been around. And when you look at an example like Wayfinders, they're able to navigate these huge expanses of ocean without what we know as today as plug-in battery-operated technology. Or even a map. They use the stars to guide them. They use the migratory patterns of animals or clouds or the color of the water, the color of the sky, all of these other tools for navigation. And I think one of the things that really resonates with me with Wayfinders is that there isn't a set course. They're navigating from point A to point B. So they have their goal in mind. They know where they're going and they have all the tools that they need to get there. Whereas other types of exploration, when we think of like, okay, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria coming over from Europe, there was a course that they had set. And if those ships get blown off course, they have to get back on course or they're doomed. They're lost. Wayfinders don't have a set course. They can't get blown off course because they're just navigating. And I absolutely love that metaphor. I think there's so much inspiration there because we're so tied to having that. Here is the path that we have to be on. And if we are not on that path, then we have to do everything we can to get back on that path. And that's just not how Wayfinders approach it.
But do Wayfinders have an end goal or do they not even have an end goal?
They definitely do. Very purpose-driven. They know where they're going and they have that vision in mind. They're navigating to somewhere specific and then they're able to do that with all of the tools that they have. So having that purpose and vision is really key. And this is an interesting point because Kelly and I, the reason that she and I were chosen to work on this book and the work that we've done, we have different points of view on this. I think Kelly feels very strongly about purpose. And without putting words in her mouth, like she did a lot of this work around purpose-driven design. And I'm a little bit like, I don't know. I don't know if you need to know your purpose in order to do this type of work. So we have very different mindsets about it, which is, I think, why it was necessary for this book to have two authors with two different points of view so that we can have that openness in the book so that it resonates with people who believe in a purpose and people who might not feel comfortable with that.
What if we'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. What's the difference between those two? So I'm interested in the positions of you and Kelly. Like, purpose-driven design would imply that what you're designing, you personally care deeply about. And non-purpose-driven design is more like it is a task. I don't want to minimize it, but more of a problem to solve.
I think purpose-driven design is partially about your vision and who you are and what you want to accomplish. But also it is about the purpose of designing for others. So it's not just centering yourself. I think in human-centered design, that's been quite an issue where people are very much initially designing for themselves. And we want people to be designing for other people as well. So that purpose is part your own purpose and the purpose of designing for others. For me personally, I have a hard time just with the word purpose. I think it puts a lot of pressure on someone to know exactly where they're going in their life and to have a very clear idea of what that is. And I don't necessarily think that that's possible for everyone. And I think that that's okay. If you're always working on what your purpose is, maybe you don't have your finger on it and you don't know what it is, that's okay in my book.
Right. Well, you don't want it to create more tension in your life. And like anything else, you talk about a balancing act and enjoying the contradictions of the opposing forces. Or what do you mean when you say opposing forces are in harmony?
We know that in design, tensions really are a great place for creativity to thrive. And those tensions could be about the physical design of an object, for example, something that is soft and hard, or something that is, I don't know, unclear and super clear. Those tensions are very interesting. They make objects more interesting and experiences more interesting as well. Any type of art, really, writing, making movies, that tension between knowing and not knowing is a really creative place to be. An example that I like to use there is from this, I can't remember what year the movie is from, but it's Queen Christina. It's a black and white movie. It's Greta Garbo. And the last scene of the movie, so spoiler alert, she's on the boat at the end and she's being sent off to sea. And the ending is very unclear. And Greta Garbo, in the very last scene, they zoom in on her face and zoom from a wide angle and zoom in. And she just has this blank expression on her face. She's unblinking and just staring out into the sea. And some people feel that she's angry and she's so upset. And other people think that she's vindicated and so happy. And the fact, when they were filming the scene, the director told Greta Garbo to just, she was acting. She was acting as hard as she could. And the director told her to make her face a blank sheet of paper, to just lose all expression. And because that happened, the audience then maps their own meaning onto her face. They map how they feel the movie ended into what they see in her eyes. And it's that tension of how is this being interpreted? When you leave space in those tensions, then people can map their own meaning to something and bring themselves into it and connect more deeply on a personal level.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think you list 5 things to balance when you're navigating ambiguity. Will you go over those 5 things?
Absolutely. So when we were initially writing this book, we had a list of tools. We had a list of 10 tools. And I think that that would be extremely convenient to have a solid list of tools for navigating ambiguity. I'm sure everyone would love to know what those are. And I guarantee there'll probably be a lot of books and other things that come out and tell you what those 10 things are. But taking the inspiration from Wayfinders, it's all about balance, balancing the wind and the sails, balancing your speed and direction, all of these different opposing forces. And when you can hold these two different things as one, then you're navigating ambiguity. So for example, we're saying that your toolkit for navigating ambiguity is really your ability to balance these different things. And it's not a definitive list, but balancing your perspective, balancing scale, balancing your attention, balancing your process or your pace, your speed. So an example of that, if we just focus on balancing your pace, the balances there are speed up and slow down. Sometimes you need to, if you're feeling the need to speed up, you're really anxious, this might be the moment to slow down. Exactly what you teach in meditation as well. This is the time to really slow your breath down and to take a moment when you're feeling the need to rush, rush, rush. On the other side of it, if things are moving really slow and you need answers, this might be a good time to do a quick brainstorm with your team or write really quickly and get some ideas down. And it's up to you to understand what do you need and when and how to try those different things, knowing that speeding up and slowing down are two realities that exist at the same time.
And then you talk about focus and unfocus, following the course, creating your own path, zoom in, zoom out, look in, look out. Like all of these are opposing forces that you get in touch with as you tap into your internal sources of motivation. Or how do you tap into these internal sources of motivation? I suppose the people that you're teaching want to learn this, but how do you initially get people to open their minds to all of these concepts and to check their judgment at the door?
And so much of it is learning through doing too. There's understanding the content of If you just take focus and unfocus, for example, you're balancing those two things, you're navigating ambiguity, you're facing some sort of unknown in the work that you're doing. And so you might balance focus and focus by saying, okay, I have all of these distractions, endless notifications, constant emails, constant Slack messages. I need to just carve out some time to focus on the thing that I'm working on. On the other side, you have unfocus, which is, as you mentioned, with the default mode network, your brain needs that time to make those connections when you're not focused on the task at hand, when you're doing something else. And it's one thing to learn that information, and then it's another thing to be working on a project with real deadlines, with real scope, real money on the line, teammates, other people who are responsible for the outcomes. You're in Q2 and you need something by Q3. So practicing those things in the context of your actual work is, I think, the best way to learn. And that's a very D-school way of doing. So learn by doing. So when it's taught, we initially started with this very specific navigating ambiguity workshop, and now it's just a part of other curriculum while you're learning the design process. And so you're learning these tools in the context of actual like application.
Yeah. And that makes so much sense. Towards the end of the book, you have this discussion around, I guess, in fact, it's the neuroscience of Mona Lisa and some of the misconceptions about why we're so intrigued by this painting. And then you write about Da Vinci's treatise on painting. I just came back from a trip to Paris and we did see the Mona Lisa. I've seen it before, but having just seen it, I was really intrigued by this interpretation. And so I would love for you to share that with us.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love this example as well. Kind of similar to the Queen Christina example. But the Mona Lisa has this ambiguous expression on her face. And for a variety of reasons, we connect with it, where we map our own interpretation onto that expression. And in fact, I think we reference Michael Gelb, who's been on this show, talking about how to think like Leonardo da Vinci and the thought that went in behind the painting. So the painting is done in a style called, in Italian, sfumato, which means up in smoke. So first of all, it's created with all of these tiny, tiny, tiny brush strokes that give it this fuzzy, hazy kind of quality. Secondly, the expression on her face, it looks the way that it does because your eye goes to focus on different areas of her face. So when you're looking at her eyes, you're seeing her mouth in your periphery. When you're focused on her smile, on her mouth, you're seeing the rest of her face in the periphery. And then your brain is making sense of what it sees based on light and shadow. So when you're looking at her smile, you're seeing shadows on her face that I think maybe look more serious. And then when you're looking at her eyes, the shadows are being interpreted as a smile. So your eyes are kind of moving back and forth between her eyes and her mouth, and it creates this flickering quality where your brain can't really settle on one interpretation, because if you look at her mouth, she's not smiling. If you look at her eyes, she is smiling. And it creates that activity in your brain, which is why it's so engaging. It's a painting. So there's the aspect of how it was painted. And then there's other parts of the story that we use in the book. For example, Dr. Margaret Livingston, that made this correlation about the shadows and how our brain works, she made that discovery, or it came to her mind when she was riding her bike home from looking at the painting, not when she was sitting at her desk, not when she was sitting in front of the painting, but literally while she was doing something else. So it brings in all of these different aspects of focus and unfocus that it ties it all in really neatly. And then Michael Gelb then talks about Da Vinci's ability to blur those edges, but then also his process, how he would work very intently on things and then disappear for days. And we can't really do that. And I'm in Silicon Valley. If I disappear for days, people are going to wonder. So can't really work like Da Vinci. But those aspects of working intently and then taking time to think and process, like, it's all wrapped up in that Mona Lisa metaphor.
Yeah. Oh, I just found that so fascinating. And the whole role of the brain and the different parts of the brain and how we interpret things, just super fascinating. My absolute favorite quote in the book is the last one by Gilda Radner. I wanted a perfect ending. Now I've learned the hard way that some poems don't rhyme and some stories don't have a clear beginning, middle, and end. Life is about not knowing, having to change, taking the moment and making the best of it without knowing what's going to happen next. Delicious ambiguity.
She really nails it there, doesn't she?
She really nails it. And I love that you found that for this book. It's just so perfect. As I said in the beginning, I found this just so rich with material to shift your lens on so many different things. I would really encourage people to pick up a copy of this book. I loved it. Is there anything else that you want to share before we close?
I think the other thing that I would want to share about the book is just the art. There's the audio version of it, which is great. And Kelly and I read it, which was super fun. But the art in the book is done by a papercraft artist named Reina Takahashi. And she's also a local Bay Area artist. The concept of the book was that the art was all done with just white paper. So all of those that look like illustrations, that's all actual white paper just shot in color, but using like darkness and shadow to build all of the detail around that. So she really took that concept of nothing is more ambiguous than a blank sheet of paper and turned it into all of this beautiful art. There's a lot of visuals in there that are just really beautiful. And I encourage people to just pick it up and take a look at her artwork, because we wanted the book to be a little bit playful, a lot of white space, a lot of room for thinking, and to not make it so, so serious, and to also give this calming vibe to the book. So I just wanted to call her out because she was such a huge part of it as well.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And I think you all nailed it, you, Kelly, and Reina. Thank you so much for being with us today, Andrea. It's really been such a treat. As I said, I love this book. So thank you.
Thank you so much. I love talking about ambiguity. So this has been a real honor being on your podcast. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today. You can find Navigating Ambiguity at all major booksellers. Don't forget to check out Muse at choosemuse.com and let us know if you have any suggestions or comments at untangle@choosemuse.com. Have a great week, and we will see you next time. We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.